spotlighting Robin Williams' battle with Lewy body dementia.
And in the next hour of Cat Radio Cafe,
a panel from Cabaret Pangea on Good Grades.
Sunday night at 11 on WBAI, Cat Radio Cafe.
And remember our slogan.
Do cats grade people?
If they did, we'd all flunk.
Join WBAI on Thursday, July 25th for an evening with Gary Null, hosted by Leonard Lopate. This is at Symphony Space in Manhattan on West 95th Street. Leonard will interview Gary about his work, his research, and his contributions to WBAI over the years. That's a $35 contribution to listener-sponsored WBAI for a ticket to attend the event. It's on Thursday, July 25th.
Good evening. Acosta resigns. Trump confirms his weekend immigrant crackdown. A labor icon dies. And 5 days of memorial. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Friday, July 12, 2019. The Federal Trade Commission voted this week to approve a roughly $5 billion settlement with Facebook Incorporated over a long-running probe into the tech giant's privacy missteps. The 3-2 vote by FTC commissioners broke down along party lines, with the Republican majority lining up to support the pact while Democratic commissioners objected. The people said the matter has been moved to the Justice Department's Civil Division, and it's unclear how long it will take to finalize. A settlement is expected to include other government restrictions on how Facebook treats user privacy. The additional terms of the settlement couldn't immediately be learned. An FTC spokeswoman declined to comment, as did a Facebook spokesman. Later in this newscast, we'll learn more about how technology is profoundly affecting individual privacy through the use of facial recognition. And U.S. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta resigned on Friday amid fresh scrutiny of his handling of the sex abuse case against financier Jeffrey Epstein, becoming President Donald Trump's latest advisor to leave the administration in controversy. Trump, who has fired numerous cabinet and other administration officials during his 2.5 years in the White House, said it was Acosta's idea to step down. Trump named Deputy Labor Secretary Patrick Pizzella as the acting Secretary of Labor. Epstein, a billionaire hedge fund manager, pleaded not guilty to new federal charges in New York this week. Epstein had a social circle that over the years has included Trump, former President Bill Clinton, and Britain's Prince Andrew. U.S. prosecutors in New York on Monday accused Epstein, 66, of sex trafficking, luring dozens of girls, some as young as 14, to his luxury homes and coercing them into sex acts. And two U.S. House committees will reportedly delay former special counsel Robert Mueller's planned July 17th testimony for 1 week to allow him more time for lawmakers from one of the panels to question him. Mueller, who oversaw the federal investigation to an alleged Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, is now expected to testify July 24th through the House before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees. WBAI will be broadcasting the hearings live. Meanwhile, in international news, Turkey began taking delivery of an advanced Russian missile defense system on Friday, a move expected to trigger U.S. sanctions against a NATO ally and drive a wedge into the heart of the Western military alliance. The first parts of the S-400 air defense system were flown to the Merted military air base northwest of Ankara. The United States has threatened to impose sanctions on Ankara, saying Russian military hardware is not compatible with NATO systems and that the acquisition may lead to Turkey's expulsion from an F-35 fighter jet program. Investors in Turkey have been concerned about the impact of potential U.S. sanctions on an economy which fell into recession after a currency crisis last year. And the White House says President Donald Trump will meet with Guatemalan President Jimmy Morales at the White House on Monday for talks on immigration and security. Government sources from both countries have said Morales may sign an agreement with Trump on Monday declaring the Central American country a safe destination for asylum seekers, while five former Guatemalan officials have gone to court to block such a deal. Guatemala is infamous for government-sponsored death squad killings of hundreds of thousands of its own citizens, stretching back to the dictatorship of strongman Rios Montt, who enjoyed strong support from then-President Ronald Reagan. And Trump said on Friday a nationwide wave of arrests of immigrants facing deportation will commence this weekend. He confirmed the plan was on track after a delay. Meanwhile, the House Oversight Committee held hearings Friday into border security and Trump's policy of separating families coming from Central America. Reports of unsanitary and demeaning conditions have filled the media and led to a fiery exchange between Democrat Jesus Choi Garcia of Illinois and former ICE Chief Thomas Homan.
That the Trump administration tried to ban asylum seeking and started the process of metering, which then prevents people from coming through legal ports of entry. That exacerbated the crisis. People are desperately waiting months just to get in line and be granted the inalienable rights to due process. Mr. Homan, you have said that most immigrants are, quote, not criminals other than the criminal act that they do when they enter the country illegally. That is why I think we ought to revisit decriminalizing desperation. Striking sections 1325 and 1326 of Title VIII of the U.S. Code, the statutes that the administration has leveraged to separate thousands of children from their families. Mr. Homan, do you understand that the consequences of separation of many children will be lifelong trauma and carried across generations? Have we not learned from the internment of Japanese Americans? Mr. Homan, I'm a father. Do you have children? How can you possibly allow this to happen under your watch? Do you not care? Is it because these children don't look like children that are around you? I don't get it. Have you ever held a deceased child in your arms?
First of all, your comments are disgusting. I've served my
country
34 years.
I find your comments
disgusting
out of control. As well.
I've served my country for 34 years. And yes, I held a five-year-old boy in my arms in back of that tractor trailer. I knelt down beside him and said a prayer for him because I knew what his last 30 minutes of his life were like. And I had a five-year-old son at the time. What I've been trying to do my 34 years serving my nation is to save lives. So for you to sit there and insult my integrity and my love for my country and for children, that's why this whole thing needs to be fixed. And you're the member
of
Congress.
We agree on that.
Fix it.
We agree on that. But I disagree. But I also disagree with your characterization of immigrants as
pro-immigrants and criminality. People for 3 decades on this.
Gentlemen, time has expired. My time now.
Mr. Chairman.
It's my time.
The gentleman ripped off about 7 different questions designed to go at the character of Mr. Homan, and Mr. Homan should be given a chance to respond. It was ridiculous the way he just rattled them all off and wouldn't let him respond to them.
Let me say this. I understand that, but I'm going to have civility in my hearings. All right? I have the floor.
I understand, and I agree with you.
I'm going to have civility. That's why I was banging, so that we could hear each person speak. I have been very courteous and very kind. Now, Mr. Homan, do you have something to say?
No one in this room has seen what I've seen in my 34-year career.
Very well.
No one has experienced what I've experienced. I've saw many dead bodies coming across this border. And you want to talk about the memo? This memo is one option to stop death, not just about enforcing the law to stop death. If you want to legalize illegal immigration, good luck with that, because it's going to get a hell of a lot worse on that border. If you say, well, okay, from now on, there will be no consequence, no deterrence. It's not illegal to come to this country illegally. More families would come. 31% women would be raped. More children would die. We're a nation of laws. If you don't like it, sir, change it. You're the legislator. I'm the executive branch. And I've served my country honorably for 34 years. And I will not sit here and have anybody say that I don't care about children because you're not the same color as my children.
Thank you very much.
It was reported earlier this week that ICE agents have been mining millions of driver's license photos for possible facial recognition matches. The efforts target undocumented immigrants who have legally obtained driver's licenses, according to researchers at Georgetown University Law Center, which obtained documents related to the searches. Sarah Hussein is a staff attorney on the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Civil Liberties team. She says all Americans should be concerned about this government invasion of their privacy.
What ICE was doing was it was going through different databases involving the DMV in 3 states, in Utah, Vermont, and in Washington. And they were using facial recognition technology to try to identify the faces of some of those people who were in those databases. And it's a really concerning matter because when those individuals, you know, people who are just driving around every day with licenses, they never consented or had knowledge that ICE was using this technology on their photos. And it's another concern that this is facial recognition technology that's being used. It's a privacy threat that the government is exploiting in new and dangerous ways. And it's prone to errors, especially for women and people of color. So the fact that this new practice has been brought to light is really concerning to us and should be of concern to people all across the country.
And let me ask you more about that. I mean, could you break that down a little bit for us? I mean, they were going to these states. They were taking photographs that were in a database. Were they the driver's license database, you know, the ones that they have, which everybody's information in that, you know, whenever you go to the DMV in your state and get a driver's license? Is that it?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, hundreds of thousands of motorists who apply for licenses and get those licenses, you know, their pictures are in those databases. What's especially concerning is the three states that I mentioned, Utah, Vermont, and Washington, offer a driver's license to undocumented drivers as well. So the fact that ICE is rifling through with this facial recognition technology means that it turns this idea of being able to drive legally to school or to work into a trap where federal immigration officials are now being able to go and exploit that those photos that those people took in order to get this benefit from the government. So, you know, it is an incredibly concerning matter. I know that in Vermont, the governor there said that they didn't even know that this was happening and that they didn't want this to sort of be the status quo. And I know that in other states, they have taken some actions against allowing ICE to just go through their databases for DMV. And I think that needs to be something that is followed in other states as well.
And they were comparing these photographs to other photographs?
We don't know exactly what they were comparing them to. What we do know is that they were using some sort of facial recognition technology. And so I think that the idea is they were trying to identify people that maybe they had in their crosshairs or something like that.
Well, my knowledge of this comes from, you know, news reports about what happens in a country like China, where they literally use facial recognition to follow millions and millions of people every day.
The way in which law enforcement, especially now, has been continuing to use facial recognition technology, it is incredibly concerning. Everyday people can be surveilled constantly through this technology is incredibly concerning. And here, I'm in San Francisco. Here in San Francisco, they just took this unprecedented step a couple of months ago to ban facial recognition, the use of facial recognition, because they're so concerned about the types of implications this has for people's privacy and a complete invasion of privacy. So San Francisco took that step. Soon afterwards, Somerville, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston, took that step. Here in California, two cities, Oakland and Berkeley, are considering also banning facial recognition. So I think people across the country are really seeing the kind of danger that they could be exposed to through the use of this technology. People are taking steps in order to try to ban the use of such a severe privacy invasion.
And you also mentioned that there's a high possibility of incorrect matches, especially if it's women and people of color.
That's right. Yeah. So there have been some studies that have been done recently, and they found out that this technology is just incorrect when it comes to identifying women and people of color correctly, where oftentimes there have been higher rates of false matches to people of color. There was some sort of study done of members of Congress where the technology misidentified 27 members of color in Congress. And so, you know, it is concerning if law enforcement is relying on these tools to identify potential perpetrators of crime or whatever they're looking for. This could be raising all sorts of false positives and sweeping whole groups of people into situations where they would have to end up clearing their name or otherwise be faced with this air of suspicion when it's not deserved.
In some cases, like in New York, where they're afraid of terrorist attacks all the time, they're constantly talking about it since 9/11. Could facial recognition technology be an important tool in protecting people?
Law enforcement has tried to talk about facial recognition technology as being an important tool, but the ways in which that we've seen it used and abused really raises a ton of concerns. And the fact that this technology isn't accurate either. You know, we really need to make sure that when we're talking about new technologies that are being employed, that they're tested, that they are not creating airs of suspicion around people who have no business sort of being under that sort of surveillance. And also just talking about the mass surveillance industry and complex that exists around the country. I think we need to be really careful about relying on technology as sort of the solution to every problem that we have. and thinking that it's going to get rid of all of our problems. Because I think as we've seen in many cases, it creates new unforeseen problems as well, and it can lead to severe government abuse, like it did in this case.
Sarah Hussein is a staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. More than a dozen U.S. states, including New York, allow undocumented immigrants to get a formal license or driver's privilege card. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The president of a union of more than 160,000 workers representing property service workers, including many immigrants, has died in New York. Linda Perry reports.
Hector Figueroa, president of 32BJ SEIU, passed away Thursday night from a heart attack. 32BJ, the Service Employees International Union, mourns his loss, and they say, for those of us who have worked with him to further the well-being of our members and working people everywhere and felt his personal and principled concern for our members, our staff, and others, this is a devastating loss. New York State United teachers said Hector Figueroa's work to empower New Yorkers, particularly immigrant communities, in the political arena was critical in shaping major debates and ultimately policies. Figueroa said in the fight to protect workers' rights and human rights, unions are all in. Back in 2017, with Donald Trump scaring the immigrant community as he is doing again today, Figueroa gave this message to WBAI listeners.
Well, to remind your listeners, we are across 11 states and Washington, D.C., so we see all different kind of reactions by our members. I would say a large number of members, because we are an immigrant union, are very concerned and are fearful for their jobs, for their families, and they feel that Donald Trump is basically setting the tone that they're no longer welcome, even though they are the people who clean our offices, take care of our children, cultivate our food and deliver it to our homes. And they feel that somehow the country that they have decided by choice to be their country is now, against them. And we try to work with them to understand that that is not reflective of the spirit of the country, that a lot of people did not vote for Trump, and that we're going to fight for them and we're going to protect them. And we're not giving up on getting comprehensive immigration reform. A second reaction that we're having is actually more militant. There are many members who feel that we have been winning with the 5 for 15, that we have been winning basic days, that the moment is really for us. They see the marches and the demonstration. They are part of it. And the best word to describe those members are that they are in defiance, that they are with the belief that we can still win despite the assault, and I agree with them. And then there is another group of members who were sympathetic to Trump. And it's no secret that we find them in our unions and in the labor movement, because they were disillusioned with 8 years of a Democratic president that their standard of living and their conditions did not improve. So just like they voted for Obama as an agent of change, they have voted for Trump as an agent of change. And we're having a conversation with these members, which can be from Pennsylvania to Long Island to even pockets in New York City, Boston, or Philadelphia, and make clear to them that he used a populist message to get elected, but that the kind of government that he is conducting is for the billionaire, by the billionaire and class, and is not in their interest. And, that's a group that I think is realizing now that what they have hoped for is not really happening. Many of them did not believe that the president was going to focus on the Muslim ban, and it was going to focus on social issues. So I would say they are at a moment where they are waiting for that economic populist message to come through. The president opposed TPP, which they welcomed that, and we actually seen TPP was a very bad policy pursued by the Obama administration. So it will take time for that part of the working class, which in the social media and the press is always described as white workers, but it's actually not just white workers. It's workers who have felt abandoned and betrayed by the Democratic Party, and they were looking for somebody to shake things up.
Figueroa said the Trump administration has been very clear that they stand on the side of the rich classes.
In this country, they clearly are trying to provoke a situation to justify doing away with our civil rights, workers' rights, our liberties. I don't trust them. They are following the playbook of fascist governments that we have experienced in Latin America. Like one member said to me in a meeting recently, I didn't leave Chile escaping the dictatorship to find myself now with a dictator in this country. And that sentiment is really very, very strong. So I think that the president has really called upon all of us to stand for our most basic democratic rights and protections. And I think people are responding, but we need to organize and make sure that his agenda doesn't get carried through. And if it does, that he will not be able to carry it on a second term.
Elected officials praised Figueroa for his leadership in fighting for causes including Puerto Rican hurricane relief and raising New York's minimum wage. Governor Andrew Cuomo called him a champion for working people, minorities, the poor, the voiceless. He said, together with Hector, we enacted New York's nation-leading $15 minimum wage, first for fast food workers and then for all workers, and the historic $19 minimum wage for airport workers just last year. He said Hector fought for and won fairer contracts for his 163,000 members, ensuring working women and men have the protections they need at a time when hard-earned labor rights are under attack on the national level. He said Hector was a force in our fight against Trump's un-American assault on immigrant communities and a fierce defender of Puerto Rico. Local 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union represents airport workers, window cleaners, superintendents, doormen, maintenance workers, cleaners, porters, and security officers in Washington, D.C., and 11 states, including New York.
And 32BJ SEIU is organizing Lights for Liberty, a vigil to end human concentration camps. The vigil is being held at this hour at Foley Square in Lower Manhattan until 9:30 p.m. And in the latest from WBAI's Weather Center, watching the Louisiana coast, Tropical Storm Barry, which is expected to be a hurricane at landfall Saturday, has continued to slowly move towards Louisiana, according to the 4 p.m. National Hurricane Center update. In August 2005, Category 5 Hurricane Katrina blasted the Gulf Coast, prompting multiple failures of levees and flooding the city of New Orleans. More than 1,300 died. Tens of thousands were stranded for days. Most disturbing, many hospital patients had their death hastened. Sherry Fink is author of 5 Days of Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. She says while this storm is much different from Katrina, it's still unknown if much has been learned about the true toll of a disaster.
This storm reminds me a lot in a scary way of Hurricane Harvey in Houston, which wasn't even a big hurricane once it hit the city, but it was a big rain event, caused widespread flooding. And also Hurricane Isaac in New Orleans, I believe in 2012, which was also a Cat 1 and just stalled over the city, caused a lot of rain. And what I think about a lot, 5 Days at Memorial, the book that you just talked about, is about what happens when people have medical issues and they're in the midst of one of these big natural disasters. And in New Orleans in 2005, what happened was that the city's hospitals were surrounded by water, and they were not protected against flooding. And so they lost power. They had to evacuate. It became very hot in the hospitals, and the helicopters were arriving. They could save one or two people at a time, but there would be, you know, hundreds of people at these hospitals, hundreds of patients, and of course, a whole city that was flooded where people were on their rooftops in need of evacuation. So, what happened is it became very, very desperate in this hospital. They waited days for rescue, and the reason why this particular hospital, why I ended up writing a book about it, why there was a lot of news coverage of it, was that many bodies were found after the storm. And it turned out that several of the staff members said that they became, told me in interviews that the situation was so desperate and they became sort of hopeless about what might happen that they decided to intentionally hasten the deaths of their patients, which is a pretty shocking idea. A doctor and two nurses were arrested and accused of second-degree murder. They proclaimed that they were innocent, and ultimately a grand jury didn't indict them. But just for things to get so desperate in an American hospital in the modern age that you know, medical staff would even think about doing something like that should really give us pause.
President of the United States was roundly condemned, and the federal government was roundly condemned for failing to act in time. There was a feeling that New Orleans was forgotten because it was a city of poor people and people of color. Was there an element of these were our forgotten people and these people were not put high on the priority list?
There's been so many looks back and failures at absolutely every level of government, every level of planning. In this case, the hospital was owned by a private corporation that didn't think about sending their own helicopters to help until many days into this situation, local leadership at the hospital. So you can zero in at a lot of levels from the federal to the local. And the key word is planning for big disasters should start locally. It should start with you and me and our families, and then go out from there as our resources are outmatched. The problem is that people who don't have a lot of resources at the best of times are the ones who need more assistance in the worst of times, and we don't always do a good job of prioritizing them.
The idea of basically euthanizing patients in an American hospital because there's no hope in getting them electricity and the things they need to keep them on life support. Was this an unusual event in American history? Did you discover that this is something that happened before, or was this unique to this circumstance of Katrina?
The things that happen in disasters are often kind of like exaggerations of daily issues that we face. So in this case, there would be people who would argue that, oh, you know, when people are close to the end of life anyway, sometimes you give them a little more medicine and they push them over the edge. Others people say, no, there's a bright line there between giving somebody comfort and intentionally ending their lives. In terms of how widespread it is, it's a little hard to know that since it's not legal to end lives intentionally. And I think what is really important to take away from this is that there were other options, that even if you're in a situation where things feel very desperate, and that's part of, you know, part of the strength in the U.S. for those who are fortunate to have the goods of society, and that's not everybody, but is that we get complacent. And so we get dependent on our technology. We get dependent on electronic medical records or our smartphones or whatever it is in the context of your particular context. When we lose those tools, and particularly here at that hospital, when doctors and nurses lost the tools they relied on that they felt helped them save lives, we can get this level of desperation.
Sherry Fink is author of 5 Days of Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. And that's some of the news for Friday, July 12, 2019. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.